VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
We do thank you for joining us on Crosstalk here on VCY America. Ladies and gentlemen, it's often said in secular circles today that you cannot be a scientist and a Christian. I mean, there are those who espouse the error that one cannot hold a sound science and have belief in God. And yet I'm reminded of Psalm 19, verse 1, where it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." Psalm 97, verse 6, "The heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory." But the secular thinking is dominating in our culture today. It's dominating in colleges, dominating in universities across the nation. I'm often reminded also of the passage in Psalm 11, verse 3, "If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do?" Well, sadly, the secular left has been shooting at this foundation for many years, but our guest today is responding to that with a powerful new book. With us today, we welcome William J. Federer. Bill is a historian, best-selling author, president of Amerisearch Incorporated. He's authored numerous books. You've heard him, America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, A Socialism, The Real History from Plato to Present, and Who is the King in America? An overview of 6,000 years of history and why America is unique. Well, he's with us today discussing miraculous milestones in science, medicine, and innovation, and the faith of those who achieve them. And we would like to welcome Bill Federer today. Bill, good to have you with us.
Jim, great to be with you.
So you write a lot about the history of America. What prompted this book?
Right, well, you see that there are teachers on campuses, and if they mention they believe in intelligent design, they could lose their jobs. Or if a student mentions that they believe in God, the teacher will downgrade them. Well, lo and behold, some of the very pioneers of the scientific revolution, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Sir Isaac Newton, they all believed in a creator. Hmm. And over and over again, they would talk about the two books, the book of creation that shows God's glory and power and majesty, and the book of revelation that shows his plan of redemption.
Wow.
And so they said they both come from the same source.
Bill, so you mentioned the scientific revolution. When did the scientific revolution begin, and who or what propelled this?
Well, it's considered to begin with Nicholas Copernicus, and he discovered the heliocentric solar system. In other words, helio means sun. He discovered that the sun was the center of the solar system, not the Earth. And this was ground-shaking. He had his doctorate in canon church law, so he studied, right, the scriptures,
mm-hmm.
And Copernicus says, "The universe wrought for us by a supremely good and orderly creator." And then after Copernicus is Galileo. He is the first astronomer to use a telescope. He actually made the telescopes and sold them and polished the glass lenses. Galileo said, "I give infinite thanks to God, who has been pleased to make me one of the first observers of marvelous things."
Wow.
And then Galileo said, "The laws of nature are written by the hand of God in the language of mathematics." He said, "God is known by nature in his works and by doctrine in his revealed word." That was Galileo.
It's interesting. We don't get that kind of information in our education system today. I mean, everything is more about introducing critical race or even LGBTism into even math story problems and everything else. But why are these quotes not given in our math classes today?
Well, there's been a shift from academic excellence to behavior modification.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the education in America comes out of the 1950s and 60s. It's this social indoctrination. Unfortunately, it is co-opted with a Marxist agenda where you want to bring division, and then out of the division, the country gets insecure and people are willing to trade their freedom for security. That's a whole other topic in my book called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, So, Bill, this scientific revolution, I mean, these names that you've mentioned so far, Copernicus and Galileo, I mean, these names are foundational as it relates to the matter of science, but these are men who believed in God.
Right. Another is Tycho Brahe, or Brahe, and he was in Denmark, and he compiled very accurate astronomical observations, which helped the subsequent astronomers. Tycho Brahe said, "Those who study the stars have God for a teacher." Hmm. And then he said, "The machine of heaven is divinely governed under a given law." Tycho Brahe was so popular in his day that King James of England went to Denmark, right, to get married, and he and his new queen visited astronomer Tycho Brahe. Well, Tycho Brahe's assistant was Johannes Kepler, and he took these accurate astronomical observations. He studied them, and Kepler came up with laws of planetary motion. It's called the discipline of celestial mechanics, called Kepler's laws. And so he saw how there were eight planets, and they revolved in this, what he called a symphony. And he also noticed that there were eight notes in music. And so Kepler wrote a book called Harmonies of the World, published in 1619, right, the year before the pilgrims came over. And Kepler said, "O Almighty God, I am thinking thy thoughts after thee." And then Kepler said, "I had the intention of becoming a theologian, but now I see how God is, by my endeavors, also glorified in astronomy. For the heavens declare the glory of God."
Wow. Recognizing certainly who the creator of the universe was.
Right, and then we have to put in Sir Isaac Newton, and he is more or less like a capstone figure in the scientific revolution.
Mm-hmm.
He is a young student there in London, and in the year 1666, there is a plague that kills a quarter of the city. And the schools are shut down. We're sort of familiar with how that works. And matter of fact, it was the same plague that young William Penn goes to London, and he sees Quakers helping out and taking care of the sick and dying, and that made a big impression on young William Penn. But nevertheless, Isaac Newton has to go out of the city into his family's country estate, and as the report was, he was walking around the property, and he saw an apple fall from a tree. And he began to meditate on why it fell down. Why didn't it fall sideways? There must be some force that pulls it down. And then he says, does that force stop with the apple tree? Maybe it goes up to the clouds, to the heavens, to the moon. And maybe that gravity goes all the way to the sun. Maybe gravity pulls us all together. And so he came up with the laws of gravity and the laws of laws of motion, that a thing that still stays still until it's acted upon by an exterior force. And he came up with laws of energy conservation, laws of physics. Even he's considered one of the discoverers of calculus, and he had the laws of optics. People don't realize that Sir Isaac Newton wrote more on the Bible, on Bible prophecies, the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, than he wrote on science.
My.
He wrote a vast amount of stuff trying to figure out where the constellations were at the time of Jesus' birth. And he thought that, you know, Jerusalem was the center of the world, and he took the dimensions of Solomon's temple, and then he did the proportions of measuring around the world. And I mean, he was really into that. And Sir Isaac Newton said, "The most beautiful system of sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from an intelligent and powerful being.
Mm-hmm.
Order and life in the universe could happen only through the willful reasoning of its original creator, whom I call the Lord God."
Wow, wow. All part of the scientific revolution. William J. Fitterer with us here today on Crosstalk. And a powerful book here, Miraculous Milestones in Science, Medicine, and Innovation. Folks, these are individuals who recognize the Creator God. They recognize the Scriptures. They were scientists as well. How can that be? Well, Bill has documented this information in the book. We'll tell you later how you can obtain copies of this. But, Bill, we're going to move from the scientific revolution. You've got another section of this book on the history of writing. And I think, where would we be without writing today? Where would we be without the printed page? And we think of the book of all books and those who gave their lives so we could even have the Bible in our English language. But you have a section in your book on the history of writing. Comment on this, if you would.
Right. So in Egypt, they had 3,000 hieroglyphic characters, but it was only for the scribes and the pharaohs to read. Only 1% of Egypt could read. Reading and writing was their secret knowledge. They had 3,000 hieroglyphs. And Sumeria had 1,500 cuneiforms, very complicated, only for kings and scribes. China had 10,000 of their Chinese characters. It was just for court records. Only the upper class could read. When Moses comes down the mountain, he does not just have the law. He has the law in a 22-character alphabet. First letter's Aleph, second letter Beth. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. It's so easy to learn, kids could learn it. Ancient Israel is the first nation where you have millions of people and everyone could read. And so this this is why they were called the people of the book, right? Because the other countries, they didn't write things down. Only the kings could write things down. And so this not only caused Israel to stand out, but it began to record since in Israel the people were the king, and since the written records were keeping track of it, right? So this kept track of the people's history of ancient Israel, and obviously the prophecies foretelling the coming of Jesus, our Savior.
So we have the printed page here, the writing itself, but it's not only the writing, it's also the printing as well that's made a huge impact.
Right, so the Egyptians and the Israelites, they wrote on papyrus. These were reeds that grew in the Nile Delta, and they'd stick them under water, get them soggy, and then they'd lay them crosswise on top of each other, and it turned into papyrus. Very durable. Well, the Muslims came along in the 6th century AD, and they conquered the Mediterranean, and they held back the ships of papyrus. And so the Europeans had a paper shortage, and they wrote less. They would find things like animal skins, like parchment, like a sheepskin or a cow, very expensive. And so the common people stopped reading. It was just for the monks in the monasteries and the upper class. Then we got China. China invented paper from tree pulp, and they would grind it up and stick together and dry it out, and they had rubbings. So they'd carve something in a stone, put some ink on it, and then lay this piece of paper over it and pull it off, and then it would have the ink on there. It worked fine. The problem, and they did it for currency and little poems and so forth, but in China they had 10,000 characters, and it was just too many characters for them to actually create a printing press and for the common people to be involved. So they sort of topped out as far as any more innovations. Korea, in the year 1234, invented a 26-letter alphabet to teach their scribes the Chinese characters, allowed them to invent a metal movable type printing press, but they were the hermit kingdom, so it didn't spread. It was Gutenberg in 1454 that invented in the Western world the first metal movable type printing press, and what was one of the first things he printed? The Bible. And so we saw this mass printing of the Bible that helped lay the foundation for the Reformation.
And we're going to pick up with that aspect of the Gutenberg Bible here right after the break. Bill Federer, our guest. You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, have you ever seen that bumper sticker of a fish with legs? What's that all about?
Chris, that bumper sticker is a direct insult to Christians and the God of Christianity. It's a perversion of the Christian symbol of the fish, which has been in place ever since the early church days. It's interesting to note that this has almost become a religious symbol with evolution. We've been saying for a long time that evolution is a religion, and now they have their religious symbol. Chris, they have to have symbols because they really just don't have any evidence that evolution has occurred. Evolution is not a science. It's the religion of naturalism, the idea that there is no supernatural God behind it all. At least that's how I see it from a back-to-Genesis perspective.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Visit our web store at icr.org/store and use the promo code FACT at the checkout when ordering your That's a Fact DVD.
Our guest today is Bill Federer. He's put together a powerful book called Miraculous Milestones in Science, Medicine, and Innovation and the Faith of Those Who Achieve Them. We are making this available our way of saying thank you for your support of $19 or more. It's a book that is 277 pages, short chapters that will encompass, a chapter on each, many different individuals. You're going to find sections here dealing with the scientific revolution. You're going to find that which deals with the whole aspect of the printed page as well, and the history of writing, and some of the names involved with this. You're also going to see a section dealing with hospitals and medicine, and a number of names. The Industrial Revolution is there as well, beyond the Scientific Revolution. If you'd like to obtain a copy of this book, it's available online at vcyamerica.org, vcyamerica.org. Or you may contact our switchboard at 1-800-729-9829. And that does include shipping. It does, as we mentioned, include the shipping, 1-800-729-9829. Bill, just as that break came upon us, you were talking about the Gutenberg Bible. And in your book here, you reveal that the Gutenberg Bible is regarded as the first book of significance ever printed.
Right, and so this laid the foundation for the Reformation. Prior to then, if there was somebody that wrote scriptures and those in power didn't like it, they just round up all the handwritten copies and burn them.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't do that once the printing press came along. Gutenberg said, "Religious truth is imprisoned in a small number of manuscript books, which confine instead of spread the public treasure. Let us break the seal which seals up holy things and give wings to truth, in order that she may win every soul that comes into the world." And then he says, "No longer written at great expense by hands easily palsied, but multiplied like the wind by an untiring machine." And so here he printed thousands and thousands of Bibles, and this caused others quickly and made their own printing presses, and now they printed it. And so again, this laid the foundation for the Reformation.
Wow.
And a great quote from Franklin Roosevelt in 1935. Roosevelt said, "The 400th anniversary of the printing of the first English Bible is an event of great significance." He goes on to say that it affected the progress of Christian civilization. The Bible continues to hold its unchallenged place as the most loved, most quoted, and most universally read and pondered of all the volumes. It continues to hold the supreme place as the book of books. And I love this quote from FDR. "We cannot read the history of our rise and development as a nation without reckoning the place the Bible has occupied in shaping the advancements of the Republic. Where we've been the most consistent in obeying its precepts, we've attained the greatest measure of contentment and prosperity."
Well, friends, you'll find many things. There are many chapters. We could spend a program on each chapter, really, or each topic here, but there's chapters here on how we got our calendar, on the Julian calendar, the Gregorian calendar. But, Bill, I'd like to have you also, let's talk about hospitals and the role of Christianity in establishing hospitals. We know the value of medical care today.
Right. Well, now real quick, calendar, AD, BC, our whole entire world uses the calendar that traces back to the birth of Jesus, right? And so you got a monk that was in 526 AD, Justinian, and he's like, "Why are we dating things to this Roman emperor Diocletian's reign? Let's change it." And in the margin, he wrote, "Anno Domini," in the year of the Lord's reign, and that took off, and that became what we're using today. But as far as hospitals, this is really important, because Christian medical professionals, doctors, nurses, are being told, "Set aside your Christian convictions and do the transgendered surgeries, do the abortions, give the euthanasia shots." And these Christians are like, "This is against my conscience." And they're saying, well, set aside your conscience. Well, lo and behold, it was the Christian conscience that gave birth to hospitals in the first place. It was not the Egyptians. They didn't have health care for the poor. Health care, as well as their eternal life, was only for the Pharaoh and those that were the upper class. India, the poor people, their belief system was reincarnation, and if somebody's suffering, it's because they did something bad in a previous life, and therefore they need to suffer really good in this life, so they'll be reincarnated better in the next life. And so if you see a poor person, what do? You step over them and let them suffer. So hospitals didn't start in India, and they didn't start in China, where you had this class society. It didn't start with Islam. Muhammad didn't say, go out and do health care for the poor. It started with Jesus. Jesus says, I was sick and you visited me. And then Jesus gives the story of the Good Samaritan. There's a guy, he's beat up, he pours in oil and wine, right? Sort of an antiseptic and an ointment. And then he takes him to an inn and says, what? Take care of him and I'll pay you more when I get back. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, whatever you've done to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So along with the gospel immediately came taking care of the poor. And so the Syrian Christians pioneered. People forget that Syrians were the pioneers of Christianity for the first four centuries. And they went all the way to China. And so they started a hospital in the city of Nisibis. And there's an Assyrian Christian Bukshishu family that had nine generations of physicians. But then in the West, we had the Roman Empire was anti-Christian until Constantine, and then he stops the persecution of Christians. And then you have people making pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and they would arrive worn out. And so at the Council of Nicaea, they decided that every cathedral where people were making a pilgrimage to, there should be an infirmary, because that would help them. Now, the word for traveler or pilgrim in Latin was hosp, H-O-S-P. That's where you get the word hospitality, right? And so it was called a hospital for these travelers going on pilgrimage, right? And so in 370 AD, a St. Basil in Caesarea had a great big poorhouse and a hospital. And then in 395 AD, there's a wealthy widow in Rome, discipled by St. Jerome, who put together the Latin Bible. And she donates money to build a hospital for the poor in Rome, take care of the sick herself. Then there's the plague of Justinian, 541 AD. 15 million people die, 25% of Europe. This is a major plague. And so in Constantinople is Saint Samson the Hospitable. Why? Because he opened up his house and for the poor to be taken care of medically. Then the emperor got sick, and St. Samson doctored him up and so gave money. And so the hospital that he started lasts for 600 years until Islam invaded. And when Islam was attacking, these hospitals needed a security force, and so they were called Knights Hospitaller, right? But then you had the Benedictine order. They had monasteries, and they had an infirmary in each monastery, and they started the first medical school in Western Europe in the Benedictine monastery in Salerno, Italy. And then you had nuns, so whole orders of nuns beginning in the year 660 AD. Now, where does this come from? The scriptures. It says that don't take a widow in unless she has washed the feet of the saints and she's been, taken care of the poor and so forth. And so you would have, initially, they were these widows, but others joined. And so in 660 A.D., they had the famous hospital in Paris called Hotel Dieu. Dieu means God, and hotel is also from that word hospitable. And so they followed a rule of St. Augustine, and they were very disciplined. But that hospital is still there today. It's just to the side of Notre Dame Cathedral. But then you have China. There's a plague that originates in China. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And millions die in China, and this plague gets into the fleas, who gets onto the camels and follows the camel trains, caravans across the Gobi Desert, the China Silk Road, and they wind up in the Middle East, and then they get on boats, and they get into the rats, and then they get off the boat in Constantinople. And in 1331, it begins to spread. by 1347. It's called the Black Death, and it goes from Constantinople to 1348 in London, and then it kills 20% of the population of London, and then 200 million are killed across Europe because of the bubonic plague, the Black Death. Crops are left standing in the field, and nobody wants to bury the dead bodies. Nobody wants to touch them. Get away from me. And so there's an order of Christian men called Election Brothers, after an ancient Saint Alexis who gave away his money to take care of the poor. And so these Election Brothers collected the bodies of the dead and gave them a Christian burial. And then some of them didn't die right away. They did the hospice care, and some of them recovered, and so they started hospitals. And so this was simultaneous with another order of men called Trinitarians. And they collected money at churches across Europe. Again, this is prior to the Reformation. And they used the money to ransom Europeans who had been kidnapped and sold into Muslim slavery. And one of the famous ones that was put into Muslim slavery was St. Vincent de Paul. And so he was a slave. He was captured off his ship. He was a slave in Constantinople. He witnesses to one of his master's wives, because in Islam they have multiple wives, and she converts, and she goes to the husband, and she preaches to him. And so this guy lets Vincent de Paul escape. And so he goes back to Europe, and in 1607 he founds a hospital, and there's an order of nuns that work these hospitals called the Sisters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul. And they staff hospitals across Europe by the hundreds. Unfortunately, the French Revolution starts, and they make these nuns line up and march them to the guillotines because they wouldn't renounce their Christian faith. And they were singing their church songs. But here you have a secular government saying, lay aside your religious convictions or we're going to chop your head. They were singing their church songs, and one by one there'd be one less person singing because they'd have the guillotine chopped down. So finally, nobody else was singing. And then you have the Great Plague of London. I mentioned that before in 1666. Mm-hmm. And then these nuns start hospitals across Europe, so much so that it was synonymous with healthcare. Even Florence Nightingale, who was the single woman that helped take care of the soldiers between Russia and Britain in the Battle of Crimea, and she said, there is no one trained better at taking care of the sick than a Catholic nun. And this continued in America. You had, even up to the Civil War, there were orders of nuns that followed the army around. And so Ben Franklin started the first hospital in America, 1755. Benjamin Rush was considered the father of American medicine. He introduced vaccinations, a little bit rudimentary back then. And then the first hospital started west of the Mississippi, was founded by, you guessed it, the Sisters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, why do I bring all this up? Because it's Christians of different denominations that feel this conviction in their conscience to take care of the poor. And yet, today, the 8 of the 10 largest hospital corporations in America were started by Christian denominations. But they're being taken over, and they're being told, if you want to get federal money, you've got to do these procedures. You got to lay aside your Christian convictions and distribute abortion drugs and all the rest of it. But it's a very powerful chapter in the book, Miraculous Milestones in Science, Medicine, and Innovation.
And it's available at vcyamerica.org or by calling 800-729-9829, our way of saying thank you for your support of $19 or more. We're going to cover one other section. There's so much more even on these things Bill has talked about, but we're going to be talking about black entrepreneurs after the break. So stay with us. This is Crosstalk here on VCY America.
How is your marriage relationship? Do you have a spirit-filled marriage? Is your marriage one in which the lost world can look in and see Christ represented? Many of us know that we are called to have such a marriage, but fail to make it happen, perhaps due to lack of knowledge on the topic. In the booklet, What Does a Spirit-Filled Marriage Look Like?, biblical counselor Susan Heck draws principles from the book of Ephesians. She presents 13 doctrines that guide a marriage that will bring glory to God. You'll learn about humility, forgiveness, generosity, unity, and much more. You'll also learn not only to know these principles, but how to grow them in your marriage relationship. VCY is offering one copy of this booklet for a donation of $6, 5 copies for a donation of $24, or 10 copies for $42. Just call 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
Never know it, would you? Our guest is a historian, also a best-selling author and president of Amerisearch, and has authored a number of books. We're discussing miraculous milestones in science, medicine, and innovation, and the faith of those who achieve them. Again, this is available at vcyamerica.org or by calling 800-729-9829 during our regular business hours, or leave a message. We'll get back with you at our next business day. Bill has a chapter in here dealing with the smallpox and the huge challenge that was. Much more information about Dr. Benjamin Rush and Ben Franklin as well. But Bill, I want to be sure we get to a section here on what you have, a section entitled Early Black Entrepreneurs. Tell us about it.
Right. So there's Benjamin Banneker, was an astronomer. He was a free black. He was a Quaker. He was in Maryland. He had a neighbor who knew astronomy and taught him, and he became so good that he put together an almanac. Now, people that are not familiar, they didn't have weather forecasters back then, so they would keep very accurate records of the stars and what positions, you know, full moon, half moon, or whatever, and what the weather was and they for the previous years, and then they would project what the where the stars are going to be the next year, what dates, and then they would project what the weather would be, and the, and also important for the tides. So it was Banneker's Almanac, a black man. He had a best-selling book, even to the time of Thomas Jefferson. He corresponded with Jefferson. Another's Robert Gordon, and he was a slave in Virginia, and he worked in a coal yard, and his master let him collect the slack. That's all the crumbs and dust, and he would sweep up that yard and keep it really clean, and he had buckets of this coal slack that he would sell, and he saved up enough money. He bought his freedom in 1846, traveled to Ohio. He bought land along around Cincinnati, and he would buy and sell coal, and the surrounding merchants wanted to put him out of business, and so they began to undercut his sales. He was a shrewd businessman, and he had some light-colored black friends go and buy the cheap coal from his competitors, and then the river froze, the Ohio River, and no more ships could come up and down the river with coal, and so he ended up having his coal plus all the cheap coal that his friends had purchased, and he was able to sell it all, make a huge profit, and he became one of the richest businessmen in Cincinnati, Robert Gordon. And then he helped start a church, an African Methodist Episcopal church called Temple. And he it was the first church like this formed west of the Allegheny Mountains. And when the Civil War started, he donated coal to the Union forces and to the Union Military Hospital in Cincinnati. Robert Gordon, a successful black businessman. And then you have lots of others. I put them in the book. Mm-hmm. There's a lady that went out to Colorado, and her name was Biddy Mason. And she actually went to California. And quite an interesting story. She was a slave, and she was her master converted and became a Mormon and made him one of his wives, and she had to follow him by foot out to California, but California is a free state. And so there was a white man named Charles Owens who brought the legal action to get Biddy Mason freed. And she was freed, and Charles Owens married her daughter. And then she ended up taking care of the sick there, delivering hundreds of babies, took care of them during a smallpox epidemic. She saved her money. She purchased two estates, and she was the first black woman to own property in Los Angeles, and her investments grew, and she amassed a fortune of $300,000, and she helped start the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in Los Angeles after it was meeting in her home on Spring Street. So that's Biddy Mason, a successful black woman. And then there's Samuel Wilcox. He was a steward on a boat on the Ohio River. And then in Cincinnati, he started a grocery business, but he decided that he would sell the best products that he could find. And he got a reputation of the best products. And everyone would want to go to Samuel T. Wilcox's store. And he had commercial links in New York, New Orleans, Boston, Baltimore, brought in these premium quality hams and dried fruit and sugar soaps. And he ended up making $140,000 in annual sales, which would be about $4.2 million today. Successful black entrepreneur Samuel T. Wilcox. There's many others. One is Frederick Patterson, and his father worked in a carriage business, and Frederick Patterson decided to start a car manufacturing company, same time that Henry Ford did, but then he switched it over to a bus manufacturing company called the Greenfield Bus Body Company. And then there's Maggie Lena Walker. She's the first black woman in the United States to charter a bank. She had her community pool money. It was called St. Luke's Penny Savings Bank, and she was its first president. But then it merged with two other banks, formed the Consolidated Bank and Trust, and she was on the chairman of the board. And Maggie Lena Walker said, "Friends and good manners will take you where money won't go." And then she says, "If you can read and write, you can do anything, go anywhere, you can ride the wind."
Mm-hmm.
And there's Annie Malone, one of the first black millionaires. She formed a Poro College, which focused on cosmetics for black women. She developed a chemical to straighten hair and to stop the damage to scalp. And she created jobs for 75,000 women around the world. And again, the first black female millionaire in the United States.
I see. Also, you've got George Washington Carver you talk about. You've got a section on innovative black educators. And I see on page 200, you've got a section dealing with George Washington Carver and his significant contribution.
Right. So it's after the Civil War, and he had been born a slave. His father died in a log hauling accident, so he never met him. The mom was kidnapped, and he was kidnapped, but then the farmer, Moses Carver, ransomed him back by getting his best horse. And anyway, he learns how to read and write, you know, goes into the little town in Neosho, Missouri, which is the same town my mom is from. And then he goes to Kansas and works all kinds of odd jobs, washing clothes, finally gets a job with the telegraph company, and then he goes to Iowa, and he's working at a hotel as a cook. And in the evening, in the weekends, he went to church. And a lady heard him sing. And then her husband went to the hotel and says, "I want to invite you over for dinner." He shows up. And the lady said, he goes, "I recognize the woman from the choir at the church." And they became friends. And he said every week he would go there, and the lady would say, "How could one person do so much?" And they interceded to get him accepted to Simpson College, which was a college of art, literature, and music, and then from there to Iowa State College of Agriculture, and that's where he studied agriculture, became a scientist, and was invited to help join Booker T. Washington down in Tuskegee, Alabama. And one of the great quotes from George Washington Carver, he says, "Human need is really a great spiritual vacuum which God seeks to fill. With one hand in the hand of a fellow man in need, and the other in the hand of Christ, he could get across the vacuum. Then the passage, 'I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me,' came to have real meaning."
Wow, wow.
George Washington Carver.
Well, folks, this and so much more in the book, Miraculous Milestones in Science, Medicine, and Innovation. We're making this available our way of saying thank you for your support of $19 or more. It's available at vcyamerica.org or by calling 1-800-729-9829. There is so much more, as we mentioned, over 200 and, 70-some pages here in the book, and that is certainly very informative, not going to come from your school textbooks today. If you have a question you'd like to ask of our guest today or a brief comment, our number to Crosstalk is 800-729-9829. That's 800-729-9829. Again, we're our topic today dealing with miraculous milestones that have occurred in science, medicine, and also in innovation. Our number 800-733-9829. You even take us, Bill, to modern rocketry and also modern space flight as well. And there are those who say, look at space and say, oh, you know, that people try to use this as a means for evolution. But those that were involved in its very inception and discovery found it to be otherwise.
Right. So there's a chapter there on Robert Goddard, and he is the one who had read H.G. Wells's science fiction, War of the Worlds, and he was up in an apple tree and saw the stars and came up with the idea of space flight, and he all they had was fireworks back then, so he began to work with creating rockets, and he would do it in his barn and his garage and ended up developing ones that could fly accurate. He developed the fins on the back of the rocket, and he developed a gyroscope system of guidance. And he says, it is difficult to say what is impossible, for the dream of yesterday is the hope of today and the reality of tomorrow. And he inspired Wernher von Braun, who was in Germany. They actually corresponded. And Wernher von Braun had worked for the National Socialist Workers' Party. But sort of like today, you have to go along with a government politically correct view, otherwise you'd lose your job. And so he did work on the V2 rocket, and but when the Allies were winning, he and the other scientists decided that they were going to defect, and they had to choose whether to the Russian side or to the American side. And he said that I myself and everybody you see here have decided to go west, and I think our decision was not one of expediency, it was a moral decision. We knew that we had created a new means of warfare. The question is, to what victorious nation were we willing to entrust this brainchild of ours? A moral decision more than anything else. We wanted to see the world spared another conflict such as Germany had been through, and we felt the only by surrendering such a weapon to people who are guided by the Bible could such assurance to the world ever be secured. Wow. So he came to the West, he developed the Saturn V rocket, which took the astronauts to the moon, and then he made some tremendous statements of faith and how he believed in Creator. He says, I have discussed the aspect of the Creator at some length because it might be the primary resistance to acknowledging the case for design. And he says that he believed in intelligent design and that the two most powerful forces shaping our civilization today are science and religion. Through science, man strives to learn more of the mysteries of creation. Through religion, he seeks to know the Creator. So one is you know about, and the other is you know.
Well, Bill, I want to get a call in before the break from Birmingham, England. Robert, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Jim and Bill. Just while you were talking earlier on, there were a couple of points that I thought of in relation to science, and one is that in terms of the processes of science, we think of the famous lecture by a man called Karl Popper on how scientific knowledge advances and the principle of falsifiability. But it's interesting to learn that it was Isaac Newton, the Christian, who developed those theories long before Karl Popper ever put them forth.
Very interesting. Thank you, Robert.
Just add one other point about early technology, because...
Robert, let me have you hold, because the break comes whether I want it to or not. So you just hold. We'll pick up your second point after the break. You're listening to Crosstalk.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. Recently, I had a group of doctors in my television studio, and then the next day, I filmed 4 one-hour town halls with them. It was moderated by Michelle Malkin. These are medical doctors. One of them, a neurologist. She studies the brain. She went into great detail as to the reactions that she's seeing from her patients in a very short period of time. brain bleeds, blood clots after receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. She also spoke of some of her patients that have Alzheimer's or dementia, who greatly accelerated in a negative manner after the shot. She also explained people getting the shot and being told in advance it's FDA approved. It is not. My friends, when I spent 2 days with these medical doctors who wouldn't take the shot, I was terrified at what I'm hearing. The problem is they're being censored. Do your due diligence.
Listening to Crosstalk on VCY America, and we're going right back to Robert in Birmingham, England. Robert, sorry to catch you off there. That break was going to come whether I wanted it to or not.
Okay, the break came up, didn't it?
Yes.
And, so I was saying that in terms of the process of gaining scientific knowledge, there's that famous lecture in 1929 by Karl Popper about the scientific process and falsifiability.
Right.
But
so,
it's interesting to discover that it was Isaac Newton who anticipated that in his theories about the advancement of science.
And you had a second point you were just making as we went to break.
Yes. I was very impressed when I went round the Linen Museum in the city of Lisburn in Northern Ireland to discover that the Egyptians discovered this process for extracting the fibers from the linen plant by fermenting the plants in a bog or something like that for about a year, so that the rest of the structure was stripped away and you were left with just the fibers. And then the linen itself is able to produce some extremely top-quality cloth, rivaling silk in its quality. And this contributes to our understanding of creation and the intelligence of early man, because there were so many bits of technology that the ancient people discovered and applied, and we think, well, how on earth did they discover that?
Robert, thank you.
Yeah, so it's important in our understanding of the history of the world, and God created Adam with an incredible amount of intelligence.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, and we'll have Bill respond here. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. You know, Francis Bacon, who's credited with the scientific method in changing from deductive reasoning from inductive reasoning to deductive, and so his famous quote, "Knowledge is power," is chiseled in stone on our Library of Congress. But Sir Francis Bacon said, "A little philosophy inclineth men's minds to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds to religion." Right? So you get a kid, goes to college, you know, in his first year there, and he learns a little bit, and, you know, he gets off into wokeism. But if he has more and more, keep studying, you'll come back around to God. And so Sir Francis Bacon said, there are two books laid before us to study. First, the volume of scriptures which reveal the will of God, then the volume of the creatures which express his power.
Wow. Let us go to Salem, West Virginia. We have Chester calling. Chester, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good to be on the program. Just wanted to make a quick comment that I noticed when you was giving the examples on the black entrepreneurs from the book. We saw many examples there of successful black people.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look around today and see many instances of successful black people. I mean, the majority of our professional sports athletes are black, and they're making millions a year. My comment or question was, why do people in this country feel like they're oppressed when you can go where you want and become what you want, if you're willing to put the work in?
Okay. Thank you, Chester. Bill, your response.
Right. So this is the, you're pointing out the fact that there's a critical race theory, which is basically Karl Marx, and he went into Germany and called it critical economic theory, and so the classes and the idea is you put them into groups of victims and oppressors. And then after World War II, they would go into Eastern Europe, and they'd call it critical
religious, and they'd break up the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Orthodox, and then they would go to other countries and have it be ethnic Bosnian Croat Serbs because they all look the same. And so the idea is you break a country into victims and oppressors, pit them against each other till there's rioting, and when everybody panics, they'll be happy to have the government come in and restore order, and the government ends up taking and switching the country to a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And so what we're experiencing is that concept that the socialists have gotten into our government and putting it into place.
Matter of fact, Bill, this would be a topic that we discussed on your book, Socialism. By the way, folks, we still have copies of Bill's book on socialism, the history from Plato to the present, and it's a powerful book. We did multiple interviews on that book, and that really discusses this in a much greater detail. When you call the number there at VCY here, 800-729-9829, you can also inquire about obtaining his book on socialism, a powerful tool. And Bill, looks like we're going to have to bring you back on that topic again here as well. Let's squeeze one last call in. This is Karen from Pennsylvania. You're on the air, Karen.
Yes. Isn't there scientific studies and scientific things in the Bible that, like you said, if people want to do the further and true study, they can find out, like, for example, to clean your hands, you have to put them under running water. And they didn't notice back then, and they wondered why people were dying and having their babies because they'd go from patient to patient. But if you truly want to know the truth, it's all in the Bible scientifically.
Yeah. Thank you, Karen, for raising that issue. Bill, much that we find in the Bible was already revealing these things even before man so-called discovered them.
Yeah. Water filters are made out of what? Activated carbon. And in the Bible, it talks about you kill the red heifer, you take the ashes, and you pour the water through the ashes of the red heifer, and then that's the water that you sprinkle on things to cleanse it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the other individuals in the book is Robert Boyle. He's considered the father of chemistry, came up with the terms element, litmus test, chemical analysis. Robert Boyle donated money for an annual lecture in England for, quote, £50 for the annual salary of a preaching minister to preach, proving the Christian religion against notorious infidels, atheists, theists, pagans, and Mohammedans, propagating the Christian religion to foreign parts. Here's the father of chemistry putting aside money to prove the Christian religion is better than the atheist, theist, pagans, and Mohammedans. Just amazing.
Yeah.
And then Blaise Pascal, the barometer basically came from him, and he had Pascal's wager. And he says, can anybody lose for being a Christian? If it turns out to not be true, you've lived a good life. But if it turns out to be true and there is a heaven and there is a hell, you've gained heaven, and your skeptical friends have lost everything in hell.
Bill, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time here on the broadcast. And as you see, folks, Bill is overflowing with this information, and you'll find much more in his book, Miraculous Milestones. You'll find it online here at vcyamerica.org or calling 800-729-9829. Bill, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jim.
And Bill has uncovered lots of information and presenting it, folks, in ways that we are not going to find it current in our textbooks here today. Thanks for joining us here on the program called Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.